Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Eliminate stress, reduce anxiety, and decrease depression. Dr. Fujian Zane's awareness integration theory has helped thousands like you get incredible life-changing results. The Fujian app gives you her evidence-based treatment in the palm of your hand. Download today.
Do you wish to wake up one day and hit the life reset button? Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want by Dr. Fujian Zane, helps you navigate crucial life areas, heal the past traumas, and cultivate fulfilling relationships and careers. Life Reset is your guide to a profound journey to reshape your life. Grab your copy on Amazon or Audible now and embark on a path to a more joyous and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian podcast. I am your host, Dr. Fujian Zane, a psychotherapist and author and the creator of the Awareness Integration Theory. So thrilled to have you join us today for what promises to be an insightful discussion. In this episode, I chat with Dr. Robert Brooks. He's a clinical psychologist on the faculty of Harvard Medical School and a former director of the Department of Psychology at McLean Hospital, a private psychiatric hospital in the Boston area. He has lectured nationally and internationally and written extensively about such themes as psychotherapy, motivation, resilience across the lifespan, parenting and family relationship, and creating a positive school and work environment. He's the author and co-author of 21 books, including Tenacity in Children, Nurturing the Seven Instincts for Lifetime Success, The Power of Resilience, Achieving Balance, Confidence, and Personal Strength in Your Life, and Reflections on Mortality, Insights into Meaningful Living. Dr. Brooks has received many awards for his work, including the Mental Health Humanitarian Award from William James College for his contributions as clinician, educator, and author, and most recently, the 2023 Trailblazer Award from World Maker International in recognition of his contribution to the field of human resilience and his innovation in creating new pathways for many. And please get a hold of him and learn more about him at drrobertbrooks.com. I'm so excited to have him on the show. We speak about how to raise your resilience, what are the components of resilience, what you can control, what you can't control, how to be empathic, how to create that wonderful communication, how to rewrite the scripts, the negative ones that you've gotten for yourself, how to find the one person in your life that could be your person who really raises you. Raises to your resilience and sees you, loves you, holds you in that light so you can do the same. I really enjoyed our conversation. I'm positive you will too. Be sure to subscribe to my podcast, my YouTube channel, and connect with me through my website, fujianzane.com, or any of my social media. Share your thoughts with me. I love to hear from you. Really, I do. Now, without further ado, here's Dr. Robert Brooks.
Intentional Parenting, a practical guide to awareness integration theory, written by Dr. Jafari, Dr. Fujian Zane, and Dr. Manoukian, three experts in human development, is your step-by-step guide to raising a healthy child prepared for a culturally integrated world. You're supported in parenting infants to adolescents using the latest evidence-based scientific research on parenting. Order your copy on Amazon now. Are you a psychotherapist looking to enhance your practice? The Awareness Integration Therapy developed by Dr. Fujian Zane is a comprehensive guide to the principle and techniques of this powerful therapeutic approach. Join the growing community who have elevated their practice and expanded their skills by embracing Awareness Integration Therapy and witnessing its life-changing impact. Order your copy on Amazon now.
I am so excited to have Dr. Robert Brooks with us. So such an honor to have you. I met you at one of the courses in the Harvard Extension School, and you came in and talked about resilience. And mm-hmm. I'm so glad you accepted my invitation to come to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me on the show.
So we would like to talk about The Power of Resilience, your latest book that you have written, and for everybody to see that The Power of Resilience, Achieving Balance, Confidence, and Personal Strength in Your Life. After being a psychotherapist for such a long time, what brought you to want to really emphasize on resilience? Because you also have, you know, raising resilient children, and you take this concept not only for the person, but to going through the family and raising the whole family from that perspective. So tell us what resilience means to you.
Okay, because first of all, there are different definitions, and then I will share with you what got me interested in resilience. When I first started, I saw resilience as bouncing back, but now more and more researchers are saying resilience is really the capacity to maintain a certain equilibrium, even when they're challenging situations. Recovery is more bouncing back, if you will, but I don't want to get overly technical. So I'll share with you what got me interested in resilience. I was trained at a time where we called it the deficit model. You mainly looked at what's wrong with people and how to fix them. And maybe I'm stereotyping a little, but that's what the feeling was. And what happened, based on certain experiences I had, one, working in the inner city of Boston, I became very interested in how someone deals with racism and poverty growing up, and yet as adults, they're much more hopeful and optimistic than you would have expected. And then one of the most difficult, challenging positions I had, most of my career was spent working in McLean Hospital, which is a private psychiatric hospital in the Boston area. And there I worked with both children and adults. And even with some kids who were really having a difficult time, that's why they were in the hospital, doing some longitudinal studies, I was impressed with many of them really then as adults doing much better in life. So I started having the shift where I said, you know what, I think I've been spending too much time and looking at what's wrong with people rather than looking at their beauty and strengths. And at that point, there wasn't too much written about resilience, so I became very interested in it and started reading whatever I could. And then it also, that interest was translated into the clinical work I was doing. It was translated into the consultations I was doing. It also made doing therapy and consultations more fun when you're also focusing on strengths rather than what's wrong with people. So I think part of it was just my experiences as a psychologist and a consultant, which really led me to look at questions related to resilience and what helps people to really deal with adversity in a much more effective way than I even would have imagined.
Absolutely. You talk about stress hardiness and a resilient mindset. So not only looking at a resilient as a bunch of our strength, like a copulation of our strength, but also this concept of a mindset that comes from that conversation. So when you're looking at somebody who's gone through a lot of trauma and this as a child, and yet they have a growth process after that, they create such a strength and they tap on their strengths as they go in. And although it's not like their vulnerabilities went away, the vulnerabilities, right, are there, but like you said, they're focusing on their strengths and moving forward versus allowing themselves to get held back by their vulnerabilities. It's as if they learn from their vulnerabilities and move forward. There's a way that you speak about how to create this kind of stress hardiness and a resilient mindset. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yes, and I'm even going to preface it by saying the following. When psychologists started to do research about resilience, like Emmy Werner, who was a Holocaust survivor, and in the 1950s, went to the island of Kauai in Hawaii and started studying kids growing up in poverty and in difficult situations. And she, every 10 years, would write a book. She died about 20 years ago now, but every 10 years, she would write a book about her research. And one of my favorites was called Overcoming the Odds. And she started raising questions, why is it that some of these children became more resilient and some did not. And then I'll get it. I haven't forgotten the question about resilient mindset, but I really want to say what her research and others found was this. Resilience is really rooted in relationships we have with other people. It just doesn't appear overnight. And so in her research, Michael Rutter in Britain was one of the foremost researchers on resilience. They basically asked the question of people who were resilient. We could have never predicted, based on how you were growing up, that you would be as hopeful and as optimistic as you are today. What do you think was the most important thing in your childhood or adolescence to help you become resilient, even given the adversity you faced? In almost every study that was done, bar none, the first answer sounded so simple, but in a very spiritual way, it's why we're all here. The first answer was, there was at least one person along the way who truly believed in me and stood by me. And in the 1980s, another one of my heroes in psychology, Julius Siegel, wrote an article where he called that person a charismatic adult in a child's life. Sometimes I wish he hadn't used the word charismatic because it has different meanings to different people, but his definition was nothing short of poetic. He said a charismatic adult is an adult from whom a child or adolescent gathers strength. So once I started using that term, giving Dr. Siegel full credit, I started getting questions like, do we as adults need charismatic adults in our lives? And I would half kidding, half not say, well, unless you've decided to be a hermit, yes, we have. So what happened was I started to believe that you could then change the outlook people have by being a charismatic adult. And certainly as therapists, we have that position available to us. Then came this question, and this is where I'll get to resilient mindset. I would have adults I saw in therapy or at a workshop say, well, what are the things we should be focusing on? Or I would have parents say, we want our kids to be resilient. What should we be focusing on? So at that point, I started to raise this question. How does a resilient child or adult see the world differently from someone who is not resilient? How do they see themselves in the world in a different way? And this was goes back a number of years, but was a very exciting part of my career as I started looking at more and more research coming out. And then what you're referring to, We had with my colleague Sam Goldstein, we were looking at some of the research, and we said, in fact, there are certain outlooks or assumptions or expectations that people have that will help them to be resilient, or if they're a parent, also help their child to change his or her mindset, if that mindset is much more pessimistic. So we made a list. And what I found, it was very helpful to me because it wasn't like I'd be checking off a list and saying, okay, point one, two, three. But in just workshops, but especially in doing therapy, I would be guided by this question. At the end of every session, have I helped this person to be more resilient and in what ways? So to me, a mindset, and now it's a very common term in the field of psychology, basically said were assumptions and expectations we have for ourselves and others that guide our behavior. And then our behavior in turn influences the mindset. So it's a continuous dynamic, if you will, circle going around and round. And it was helpful to me. I like guideposts. I don't follow them rigidly, but I like to have them. And where it's also helpful is when I would consult to teachers in schools who have kids, there all day, is how do you create a classroom where one of the things, in addition to kids learning, you're really helping them to be more resilient by what you say and do. So somewhat of a long introduction. Resilience is rooted in our positive relationships we have with significant adults. And as adults, we need those adults in our lives. And then there are certain characteristics of a resilient mindset that the charismatic adult can use for themselves also and for people in their life.
Yes. So
that's the background.
Well, the two conversations that you were having brought me into my own journey where, mm-hmm. again, someone who, came alone at age 12 and a half from Iran and kind of raised myself. And going through a lot of the traumas and plus immigration processes, mm-hmm. There's a lot of low self-esteem. And the first adult, charismatic adult that I came back into, came into my world to be able to kind of support my raising myself was my therapist. So I did go to some of the self, you know, progress seminars, and that was the first concept. And then it's like, oh my God, I need more work. And I went to a, you know, therapist, female, male, different concept in order to have that. But then it was interesting. In one of these self-growth seminars, was one of the seminars, which was like 1 year long. And they would tell us to write what we had gone through that whole month. And then somebody, like an announcer, you know, as one of you raise your hand and you wanted to share, the announcer would share what you had written, which usually, you know, I would write it from like a vulnerable place and things that did not work and all of that. And the announcer would change the script, would announce me or anyone who was walking in all of their greatness. So they would change these sentences and apply it and state it as greatness. So by the time you got off your chair and was walking in front, you know, you kept like, you kept pumping yourself because you were hearing all of these things like, that is me. Oh my God. Yeah, that is me. Oh my God. And it was the first time of an experiential experience of rewriting the negative scripts that was coming from me and somebody else was feeding it back to me from another view. And I know one of the key points that you share about is rewriting your negative scripts.
Yes. Well, I love the story and it's so fascinating what occurred there. Yeah, and in The Power of Resilience, there's a whole chapter, rewriting negative scripts. And the reason I used it, especially in therapy, especially with my adult patients, was they seemed to really like it. I would say, okay, this is your script now. It's almost like it was done here. What would you like your script to be? I mean, and then we would look at, though, what they like the script to be. We would then look at the major part of resilience, problem solving. Okay, how are you going to solve problems? But the other thing is, and a mistake I made as a beginning therapist, I did not prepare people enough for the possibility that the brilliant strategies we talked about in therapy may not work. And some of them then felt more upset and angry. So there was a book years later, but I was doing some before that, Rethinking Positive Thinking, where basically Gabriel Utengin, the psychologist who wrote that book, says, whenever you're looking at certain goals or strategies, you should also think about the possible obstacles. Now, if you just stop there, you can have a self-fulfilling prophecy for failure. But then she would say, and then think about how you would handle those. So what she was really saying, which I found was very helpful, is we're going to have, there are going to be strategies come our way. Some are going to work, some are not going to work. That's just going to happen. But she prepared people in terms of when there are those obstacles, think about how you would handle it. What script would you have? And it's interesting, the notion of scripts really seemed to, people seemed to gravitate towards, like if I was working with parents or teachers about their child or student, same thing. Here's the script we want to change, and then let's look at how we handle it here. There's, you know, sometimes concrete images help people to move forward in that regard. So I started saying, and I by the way, you also look at, you know, what were some of the scripts, negative scripts I had? And sometimes you don't follow your own advice. Like I always share this. My oldest son, Rich, who's very successful today, he did no work in the 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th grades in school. He thought homework was optional. I did not, nor did his teachers. But I mean, it's almost embarrassing to tell you this. The moment I came home, I'm working at a psychiatric hospital where I'm Dr. Empathy. The first question I would ask Rich is, out of my own anxiety, did you do your homework? And I use that as an example. I said, why would you immediately start with an area, a question that is so going to bring so much tension, rather than just saying, I love you and having a nice dinner together? But part of changing scripts is, I found, is too often we think it's the other person who can change, not us. I've heard some, it's almost comical. One woman said, I'd be in a good marriage if I wasn't married to him. One teacher said, I'd be a good teacher if I didn't have students like this. And that gets to, and I'll just finish with this, though. That gets to one of the most important parts I have found over the years related to resilience. And I call it in my books personal control. It's like the serenity prayer that resilient people focus on as much as possible what they can have some influence on, rather than trying to change things they have absolutely no influence. And for me, personal control is very powerful, because what you're looking at is, what is it that I can do to change the situation? It's not blaming yourself. It's taking responsibility. And I think one of the books I often, well, I've read about seven times, that's been so powerful for me, was psychiatrist Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, where he, half the book is, he was in the concentration camps, he's a psychiatrist. The first half is about his experience in the concentration camps. And he has some beautiful quotes in there. One is, even in the concentration camps, there were a few brave men and women who would give away their last morsel of food to someone who was even more hungry than they were. They proved the Nazis could take anything away from you but the last of human freedoms, to choose your attitude and your response in any given set of circumstances. And I remember the first time I read it was many years ago. And I said, even then I said, to be able to say that when you're in hell, that you can maintain the sense of dignity. So that's very dramatic. But I think in all our lives, we have to really then look at what scripts have to be rewritten. And we have to realize that we really have control over only one person in our life. That's ourselves and our attitude and response. So again, a long answer to the question, but I just feel personal control is a vital part of resilience. And I'm not saying it's easy. If any of this was easy, people would see me for one session, say, you know, I'm better, and go on. It's a whole process. It took me several years and my wife's advice to stop asking Rich if he did his homework.
I actually met Viktor Frankl's, Dr. Frankl's grandson.
Really?
Yeah, who had made a particular video of him, which is he was talking, you know, to his family and a lot of the conversation. So I have that video and it was beautiful.
Oh, that's precious.
It is precious, yeah. So when we talked, you talked about how to, in your book, it says like, choose a path to become stress hardy based on what you just also said, rather than stressed out. So stress is always there. Like there's no way to get out of the stress. But it's, do we allow that stress to just, you know, push us down? Or is it that we allow that stress to, you know, engage in activities and do things where we're utilizing the stress to move us forward in things and handle the stress and learn how to handle the stress? And that's what also part of the key points of resiliency.
Right. If anyone says they're never stressed, either they use a lot of denial or they don't know what stress is. We all feel stress at times. The concept of stress hardiness, which I used to use before, getting into more of a resilient mindset, basically says there are things we can do. We could to prepare for when we're stressed. And it gets into, one is basically personal control. I think they call it control. Another is connection. And that has to do with the charismatic adult. That is why, and I'll just take a little detour here. When I see people in therapy or when I'm giving a workshop, I'll always ask people this. Who are the charismatic adults in your life right now? Who do you turn towards? And I'll often say two or three, tell me. I always love it when someone says, I could tell you 20. I said, you're very fortunate, but two or three. But then I'll also say, and we could get into this later, I'll also say, what two or three people consider you their charismatic adult? Because in order to be resilient, not only do you need people from whom you gather strength, but more and more you have to start giving back, because this is what is a sense of purpose and meaning. And the other part of the, I called it the three C's, stress hardiness. It wasn't my idea. It was, out there. Had to do with challenge, to be able to, your mindset sees things as a challenge rather than saying, oh my God, another thing coming up. You're basically, your mindset is, okay, I've solved problems in the past, whatever. How do I see this as a challenge and what can I learn from this? Now, I always tell people it's easy to say this, but it's not always easy to fulfill. So I really like to ask questions about the relationships we have. And it's interesting to ask kids who they turn towards. And when I talk to teachers, I say in much of the research, sometimes the charismatic adult in a child's life turns out to be a teacher, because teachers will sometimes say to me, this kid comes from a really difficult background, whatever. And I said, that means for some kids, the only moments of sanity, security, and love they'll experience is in your presence. So don't look what they there. Look at what you know you have control over.
Yes.
And I find when I talk about, say, the three C's, or I talk about a resilient mindset, and there are other things certainly get into, there are things that I think one can do. I would never want things that people cannot do. You don't have to do everything at once. But I do think that we're all going to experience stress. I mean, if you look at the first year or so of COVID, the stress. And a lot of people felt they had very little control over what was going on. But I would focus on in my webinars, what is it that we do have control over that regard? So I'm sorry.
Sure. You were sharing about the serenity prayer. And yeah. You know, I also work with individuals, couples, but also a lot of people who are suffering from addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, as you know, that a lot of people's motivation about dealing with their addiction and going into recovery is actually someone who is their love. They really hold up high, and they see themselves in someone else's eyes as important. And finally, that kind of receiving of love and importance and being knowing that they're significant in someone else's life, whether it's their mate or their children or their parents or a good friend, it motivates them to even go into the process of recovery.
Yes.
And kind of continuing the concept of recovery. So mm-hmm. not only gives them that element of resilience and motivation, mm-hmm. but it pulls them. So the satisfying relationships that, you know, people create in their lives, is also their healer, is also their motivator. It brings them out as you know, general species, that we're a herd community. We come out of ourselves and become part of that community that we know loves us and wants us, wants mm-hmm. to see our best and the strength.
Yes, I love what you just said. I'm going to underscore it, because I think if I look at a resilient mindset, something I've been doing probably more writing about is this whole notion of what I call contributory or charitable activities. And I just want to give you a little background. Many years ago, one of the first books I ever wrote was, I was asked to write a book, if I was almost to create a school, what would it look like? And it had to do with school climate. And to make a long story short, I said, you know what? What do people remember about school? I mean, what are some of the things? And so I gave out this questionnaire. I'll only go over the first question. And it was just a short four questions. It was, of all the memories you have of school, and this was given to people between the ages in their 20s through their 70s, what is one of your favorite memories of school? But I wanted to see the impact of an adult, something an adult in the school said or did that boosted your self-worth, your dignity. And one of the most common memories, which at first surprised me, and now I was surprised, was when you were asked to help out. I would get things like, I remember when a teacher asked me to tutor a younger child. I remember when a teacher asked me to pass out the milk and straws. And I remember at first saying, these are some of your most powerful memories of school. And now we know there's a whole body of research, and you really alluded to it in your beautiful example, that whether you're 5 years old or 95 years old, that when you feel that in any way you're enriching the lives of others, it enriches your own life as well. And now we're finding that it is a major part of stress hardiness, and it's a major part of resilience. There's some research, longitudinal research, that shows two people may be experiencing what seem like the same stressful events. One seems not to show any, you know, feel it. And what they found is the ones who are not feeling it as much, they're also involved in helping others. That's why when I go into a school to discuss a kid who's having problems, one of the first questions I ask is, what is one thing this child or adolescent does at school that makes him or her feel that they are making a positive difference in the school? And this, for me, it's a whole issue of purpose versus meaning. Richard Davidson, a neuroscientist and psychologist, found that parts of the brain are activated when people are helping others. So some parts of the brain that haven't even been activated as much, but they have to do with well-being. Yes. So that to me, one way I started my books about resilience, you know, raising resilient children, is that provide children with opportunities to be of help to others. And that's how you also teach compassion and caring without lecturing about it. And that's why I kidding, but not kidding so much, I would say to parents, don't tell your kids, do your chores. No one likes doing chores, or very few. Say, I need your help, or this has been very helpful. Because words can be very powerful in that regard. And that's why in any assessment I will do, I'll often ask people in which way they feel they are being helpful to others. And I make sure I say, I don't want you volunteering 20 hours a day because then you're going to burn out. But think about those small things you can do.
Yes, and actually one of the key number three is view your life through the eyes of others. I teach at California State University, Long Beach, and I teach well-being and then another course, which is drug and health. And one of the things that I've done is I ask my students to actually teach each chapter and come up with these elaborate chapters and presentations. I want to tell you, Dr. Brooks, it's amazing to me. And I teach drug and health in two classes, right? So wonderful. I have them 4 days. And so we're talking about the same chapter, but I have two people in two different classes sharing the same chapters or presenting. Mm-hmm. I want to tell you, every one of them teaches better than I do. These presentations are so awesome. I keep looking at them and I'm like, this crying professor. And I'm like, oh, beautiful. They engage everybody and they talk about their personal experiences. They brought today, we had a teaching about psychedelics. So one of them creates the whole PowerPoint from a psychedelic concept. So although there's words in the front, the back, and there are all these kind of like psychedelic concepts. So the whole presentation was an experience of psychedelics. So I really got this concept as you were sharing that when they see that they're teaching, they learn more, they bring themselves into a space, they ask the others, they get them involved. And it has become a whole different experience for me. I'm not even talking about them, just for me watching them, glow in this way is amazing.
Well, just your whole face glowed. So, you know what? If I would 20 years to give them a questionnaire and say, what was one of the most exciting experiences in school? I bet they would mention that. Where one, there's several things. You really gave them a sense of control because they're presenting. And you said it, the best way to learn is to teach. I remember the hours I would put in when I, the first college course I taught, because you do want to look like you know the subject matter, but then to turn it over to them, it's for me, there's several aspects of resilience there. It has to do with problem solving. It has to do with making a difference in the life of someone else. It has to do with also sometimes trial and error when we're developing a talk and being able to go back and say, I would do this differently next time. So sign me up for your class. You sound like a real charismatic teacher there, and I'm sure you are in that regard. And there was before I lose this train of thought, because you've said it several times about seeing yourself through the eyes of someone else. In every book I've probably written about resilience, whether about kids or adults, there's a chapter on empathy. Daniel Goleman, his work, Emotional Intelligence and Social Intelligence, says empathy is one of the most important things in terms of creating relationships with others. And as a matter of fact, I got so interested in it that parents or teachers or just didn't have to be in any specific role would say, what are some questions? And your comments trigger this. What are some questions we should be asking ourselves to help us be more empathic? So let's say it's a parent. I'll always say to parents, what two or three words would you hope your children use to describe you? And then I think we have to be very intentional. It doesn't mean we have to be rigid, but I then say, what are two or three things you regularly do so your children are likely to use the words to describe you that you would like? And then what words do you think they would use? Now, if I had asked those questions when I was nagging my son Rich about his homework, it would have come to me much sooner. I would have loved him to say, my father cares about me, it would have on and on. But if I was truthful, I'd have to say, my son feels I only care about his grades or things like that. And the same with teachers. I bet if I went into your class and asked those students to describe you, the class you just had, I bet there would be really very complimentary words, because just as you were describing it, I said, oh, this is great. And I'm sure they experienced firsthand. So to be able to start think about how we would like to be seen, to think about our actions, because it's up to us. Many people have said is very powerful. I ask the same questions if I'm seeing a couple in terms of how they would like to be seen. What do they intentionally say or do? So it's off a little, but a couple times you mentioned seeing oneself through the eyes of someone else.
That's the key number three of your book. That's what I was sharing.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's certainly important. And over the years, I've seen it even as more important. And it's, you know, that I like to suggest sometimes questions to think about, you know, just to think about. And one of those, the one about empathy, I have some really funny letters, some of them, where they people who heard me speak and then tried some things. One woman came home and she said, I realized when I was listening to you, I wasn't as empathic with my husband. He came home early to watch the kids so I could attend your lecture. So she said, I came home. I'm laughing as I tell you this. And I was really nice. I was, you know, asking how things went, and I really appreciated. And he turned to her, because he wasn't used to this, said, were you out drinking with your friends again? You know, because sometimes when you change your script, the other person is not going to know what you're saying or why you're saying it.
What did you do to my wife? Where did she go?
No, it was really something on that. So I say, you know what? Do it. And if you're driving a few people crazy, you know, in the process, wondering why you're doing it, they'll come around, especially if it's in a positive way.
Yes. I want to say this also, that resiliency, as in your book, also talk about communicating effectively, because obviously nobody knows who you are. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows your intention. Nobody really knows what's going on with you. So part of you feeling your strength is the having the ability to communicate effectively. And as you said, one of the biggest impacts for your strengths and resiliency are the people around you. So if you have the ability and you learn the skills of communicating authentically, verbally, nonverbally, sharing who you are, you know, accepting yourself, knowing, being empathetic toward yourself, and sharing all that is about you, and then listening, you know, part of the relationship you were talking about is having that kind of an active listening from others. And that is also an important part of the Power of Resilience book that you share and go specifically into, how to communicate effectively, how to care for yourself, how to accept yourself and others, how to make connections with compassion and empathy. And so if you like to share a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah, there's a number of things in there. So I use the term empathic communication a lot, and it would take me an hour to talk all about it. But one of the things, and people could go to my website, which is just drrobertbrooks.com. About a year and a half ago, I wrote three articles in terms of communication. How do you prepare people to hear a message they may not agree with? So that they don't have this immediate response and that. And a lot of that came from I'll say, failing in that. And just to give an example, I started finding that sometimes I would be presenting an idea and I really didn't prepare the person for it. So let's say I did an evaluation of a child, and what I was finding was somewhat different from what the parents. I would always then prepare them by saying, I'm going to go over, my evaluation of your child. If anything does not sound like your child, please let me know. It's not that you're right or I'm right or you're wrong or I'm wrong, but it's how do we figure this together? And I found I've worked with a lot of adolescents, the number of times they didn't want to hear what I had to say. So I would say, I have something to say to you. If you disagree, would you please let me know? Because I know they're going to disagree, but what happens, it diffuses the situation in that regard. So one is, a teacher who thought, because I wanted one of my patients to be able to help out, and she said, why should your patient help out? He's not doing his own work. And I didn't handle it well, but I learned from it. Because part of the reason he wasn't doing his own work was he didn't feel like he really belonged in school. And I was trying to say, if he had a little job, he might belong there. But she said to me, she was very direct. She said, your whole philosophy seems to be spoiling children. And I didn't handle it well. But someone said, how would you handle it now? I would say, I have something to say to you. Some people feel sometimes it's like spoiling kids. If you feel that way, please let me know, because that's not my intention. So in really empathic communication, I started to say, in any communication, what do you hope to accomplish? But then are you saying or doing in a way where the other person is most likely to hear you? And there are many more examples. People could go to my website. I selected different things. And the other thing I want to emphasize, which was also one of these transformations for me, is I felt that as a beginning therapist, too often I focused on what was wrong with people, as I had said earlier. But parents would come in to see me about their child's having problems. I could spend an hour and a half just talking about the problems. Or an adult comes in, I could spend an hour and a half just talking to them about their problems. And it was at that moment I was really starting to feel more depressed after these sessions. That, because all we're talking about is the negative. So to make a long story short, I said, the very next patients I have, whether children or adults, after 10 or 15 minutes, especially with the adult patients or the parents, I'm going to say, now that I've heard about some of the problems, could you please tell me what you see as your child's beauty, their strengths? And then I coined a term, now it's 40 years ago, their islands of competence. It was just a term which seemed to stick there. I was amazed how the whole tenor of the meeting started to change. And years later, I'm reading this research like by Richard Davidson, that neuroscientist, who says when positive emotions are introduced, it actually helps people to be better problem solvers, to think of options. So things were going on in people's brains I didn't even appreciate then. But when you could start talking about the strengths, it starts changing a mindset. And there was a principal of a school, he was principal of a school for kids with special needs. And he came to two straight summer talks I gave. He must have been a glutton for punishment. But he brought with him, he said, after I heard you speak the first time, and he had this one sheet of paper, before any child could be discussed, it's the teacher had to fill out, what are the child's islands of competence, list as many as you can, and the second section, how are you using these islands of competence to help this kid feel more motivated and dignified in school? When they had to fill that out, he said it was a whole different kind of meeting, because they went in with a different attitude on that. So I wanted to just bring in those couple of points about islands of competence and thinking about our strengths. And what are our own strengths there?
Yes. I want to also share these with everyone. Another book is Raising Resilient Children by Dr. Robert Brooks and Dr. Sam Goldstein. And there's another book you also have about children, which I want people to
know. Well, there's one raising, it could be, oh, that's
tenacity. Yeah, tenacity.
The other is called, that's a more recent one. There's Raising Resilient Children is one. And the one about adults through our senior years is a book called The Power of Resilience, which came about after writing a couple of books about kids. Yeah. And that's the one you show them. After writing a couple books about kids, I had so many adults say, are you going to write a book about adults? And so this is not a book about being a parent or whatever. It's really many different examples of adults becoming more resilient in their life.
Anything we have missed that we need to share?
I think we've certainly covered a lot, because your experiences just resonate with mine, and your comments just resonate with mine, you know. And I think we could all, within ourselves and with appropriate, you know, real support and encouragement, I think people can learn to be more resilient, to handle the adversities that they face, more so than they may realize. And just what you told me about your life, and also, you know, the whole class where someone almost like reinterpreted what you wrote and really looked at the strengths. Those are all wonderful ways and techniques, I'll say, to really helping us to self-reflect on our lives.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with me and with our audience. I really had enjoyed our listening to your lecture and having you be at the class at Harvard. And it was wonderful today to chat with you and learn much more about you. And the invitation is always open.
Okay. Well, if I could think of other things, say, yeah. But thank you so much for having me. It was delightful to be interviewed by you, and you share, we share so many of the same interests, so it made it even more so.
Yes, absolutely. And for all of you who are out there, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. And until next week, bye-bye.
Break free from the forces holding you back. Get the life you deserve. Eliminate stress, reduce anxiety, decrease depression, and start living your full potential. Thousands have used Dr. Fujian Zane's Awareness Integration Theory, an evidence-based behavioral health breakthrough with incredible life-changing results. Getting rid of past trauma, having fulfilling relationships, increasing earnings, and living their best life. Now, the Fujian app is available to everyone. The app is Dr. Fujian Zane's Awareness Integration Theory in the palm of your hand. Download the Fujian app today.